Okay, we're here for the final hour in the behavior session for today. Our next session number is 37613, and we have a bonus. We're having a tag team presentation with Dr. Suzanne Hetz and Dr. Daniel Estep, who are both certified applied animal behaviorists. So Dr. Hetz, I believe, is starting.
Okay, have you all hit the wall yet as far as like being able to absorb information and keep your rear end planted on a hard surface? Okay, we're going to end today with a fun topic, talking about fighting cats. I'm sure some of your most favorite cases to deal with, as they are ours. I'm going to talk to you about some things here in the first part of the session, and then Dr. Estep's going to finish up. This is a good starting point. We hear a lot of things about, oh, you don't own a cat owns you, and cats can't be trained, and all this kind of stuff. And for the most part, there's a lot of myths and misconceptions there. Cats have a very different social history, a very different social structure than dogs do. So if we're trying to compare them to dogs in terms of how you train them, how you work with them, yes, there are some very clear differences. Just so that you can kind of get a sense of why problems develop between cats, just take for a moment this one slide, and just let me remind you where the domestic cat came from. He was domesticated from the African wild cats, Felis silvestris, which is this guy up here. Felis libica, which is this guy up here. The European wild cat, Felis silvestris, some people feel was also in the cat's history. Some people feel these are just subspecies of the same species. This guy is a pretty sociable, much more sociable than the European wildcat, who, when in some of the literature reports, people try to tame these guys from the wild, they're usually pretty unsuccessful at doing it, whereas these guys are much more amenable to training than these are. In reality, both of these species are nocturnal animals. Not much is known about their behavior. They have not been well studied in the wild. They are solitary. What that means is, so that there's not some confusion, and I think I have another slide about this, but solitary animals are capable of raising young on their own without living in a group. They may form aggregations, which we'll come back and talk to in a minute, or social groups, but they don't have to in order to raise young and survive. As compared to most species of canids, like the wolf, they really need that group structure to be able to reproduce and raise young. As you can see from this slide here, cats' appearance have changed relatively little throughout its domestication history, especially when you compare that to dogs. I mean, cats have only been domesticated for about 4,000 years as compared to probably 15,000 years or longer when it comes to dogs. In the wild, these guys can live on their own, come together for mating. They may not form groups at all. With the domestic cat, we know under wild conditions or feral conditions for the domestic cat, they can live in groups. Feral cats do form colonies. So this guy has had to, his behavior has been modified to allow cats to have a more flexible social system. There are still many feral cats that do live on their own outside of colonies. And what we know for most of the people who do research into feral cat behavior, that whether cats live dispersed, kind of on their own, or whether they live in groups really depends on the availability of a food supply. If you have a clumped food supply, like a garbage dump or a dairy farm or somebody feeding a colony, then cats are much more likely to form these colonies with some degree of social structure within them, as compared to if the feeding supply is quite dispersed, then the cats are going to be dispersed. If they're kind of hunting on their own and bringing down, eating mice and rats and voles and sometimes birds, they're probably not living in a group. Some other things that have happened throughout domestication is obviously cats have had to learn to tolerate people, to decrease their flight distance to people. And there's also been what most people feel is a change in some of their vocalization patterns, in that many cats don't meow too much to one another. Most of the meowing that cats do is to people. The exception to that are the meows that go on between mom and kittens, caregiving and care-seeking kinds of vocalizations. So I've already said that they are solitary predators. They're capable of raising young without a social group. And their social structure can vary as far as the domestic cat goes. And I think, well, because of that, because they still are, many of them can be very capable living on their own, especially when they don't have the food supply to live in a group. Many of them may have difficulty with group living. And when you look at, again, some of the studies of feral cats that have been done, or free-ranging cats that have been done, and you compare the densities of free-ranging cats even around a clumped food source, some of the densities that cats live at in a household can be 100 times greater than what they live at in densities under free-ranging conditions. So it shouldn't be too surprising to us that some of them have trouble with living in groups. When we talk about cats who do live in groups under free-ranging conditions, many of those aggregations or colonies are organized around matriarchal lines. In other words, the moms have kittens, the females tend to stay, the males often disperse. And Dr. Sharon Crowell Davis at University of Georgia has really done some good research, she and her graduate students, and have documented that related females can engage in cooperative raising of the young, which she calls midwifery. And as I already mentioned, these indoor densities can be quite a bit greater than what you see under free-ranging conditions. Consequently, because cats have a more flexible approach to social structure, there can be significant individual variation in their tolerance of living in a group. The cartoon, I know, is that big enough for you all to read in the back, or do I need to read it to you? I'll let you look at it. If Lassie had been a cat, Timmy wouldn't have lived through the first TV season. Because here's Timmy trapped in the quicksand. Go get a rope, girl, help me out. And the cat's going, oh, I wonder who's going to bring me dinner if Timmy dies in the quicksand. So even when cats do live in groups, those groups are not analogous to a highly structured wolf pack, for example, or group of canids. In some situations, the group may be nothing more than an aggregate of animals with not a whole lot of individual relationships. We also know from Dr. Crowell Davis's research that within that group, that some animals can form quite close social bonds and spend a majority of their time in proximity to one another. So it can be really quite variable whether there's any social relationships going on or whether some of the cats do form quite close social relationships with one another in that group. What you typically don't see, however, are these very structured, very rigid linear dominance hierarchies that people have written so often about in the wolf pack. And even in the wolf pack, this is a little bit of an oversimplification, but you certainly have much more structured social relationships and social hierarchies in groups of wild canids than you tend to have in groups of free-ranging cats. Sometimes, even within a household, what you'll see is this kind of a relationship where there's one kind of cat in a dominant role who's able to kind of run the other cats around. But there may not be really clear social hierarchies among the rest of the cats in the family, in the household. Or sometimes you'll get kind of a mixture. Maybe there's, you know, some clear social hierarchies between a couple of these guys, but not between all of them. So it can be pretty flexible and pretty variable depending on the individual nature of the cats that are involved. We can have situations where you can have 2-3 cats in a household and they've lived together fine for a number of years, and either one of them dies or the owner decides to bring in a totally new cat, and this new cat does not fit in at all, even though this other group has done quite well for a number of years. So a lot of individual variation there. When we talk about why cats can get into trouble with one another, they're seldom dominance motivated in the way that we think of how they are with dogs. If we're talking about social hierarchies, allocating resources and minimizing competition for resources, cats tend not to guard their food or their toys like dogs do. They may be quite possessive, for lack of a better word, of preferred resting sites, window perches and that sort of thing, but they tend not to get into these competitive interactions among things like food and toys and attention from the owners quite the way that dogs do. What are the sources of this individual variation? Why do some cats seem to get along just fine and other cats just never seem to get there? Well, certainly there are some genetic influences there. Dennis Turner and Patrick Bateson. The older I get and as the day wears on, I'm having trouble pulling up words and names. But Dennis Turner, who's a behaviorist in Switzerland, has done a lot of work on individual personality types in cats along with Eileen Karsh. And they've identified three personality types, and I don't know if I can remember them. I know one is kind of a confident, bold personality, one is more of a timid, shy, and one is more just kind of an easygoing, never met a stranger kind of personality. So if you get one of the ones that's kind of overly confident and real bold, and you mix that with one who's real timid and shy and quite easily frightened by stuff, that's probably not going to be a good match. Obviously, early experience socialization history is quite important. Eileen Karsh has identified that the sensitive period for cat socialization to people is 2 to 7 weeks of age, quite young. What's interesting is that, to my knowledge anyway, there haven't really been any good controlled experiments to look to see what the prime time is for cat-to-cat socialization to other cats. In dogs, we assume it corresponds with the socialization, sensitive period for socialization to people, which is between 3 and 12 weeks. So we kind of assume that the same thing is true here with cats, but I don't think really anybody's ever looked at that, cat-to-cat socialization and optimum time frames for that. The types of experiences that cats have with one another, if the only interaction a single cat in the family has, for example, with other cats is to watch them invade the cat's territory, watch them through the window, and they spend a lot of time hissing and charging at the window, and then a person wants to bring in another cat, that may be a problem. I think also Kim Berry's research, she was a graduate student of Sharon Crowell Davis, found that, didn't she find that male-female pairs tend to do better than, and female-female pairs as well, that male-male pairs were more likely to have problems than other gender mixes. We know that cats are quite territorial when it comes to one another. They're both, and they're also sensitive when it comes to interpersonal distance. Here you have kind of four cats who have arranged themselves on the bed. An old Flame here in the middle flips over on his side and invades Hazel's space, and we have a little swatting match going on. So cats are quite sensitive to their own individual space. We know that they can stay aroused for long time periods, that once they get into one of these aggressive states, it can take them a long time to come out of it. And we also know that cats don't handle conflict as well, social conflict, because they're not predisposed to live in these highly structured groups. They sometimes have a hard time settling things. They don't have a way, as many good ways as dogs do, to avoid conflict through ritualized body postures. Cats do not have the equivalent of canine submission. They don't have a clear signal to play like dogs do with the play bow. So for some cats, until they get familiar with one another, attempts at play may be misunderstood and actually result in fights because the other cat doesn't get that the one cat is just wanting to play. And they just don't have as much signaling capability as group living animals do. Their body postures are much more subtle and they change rapidly, so oftentimes this makes it difficult for owners to realize when the cats are kind of posturing at one another and to identify warning signs where they could interrupt behaviors before they result in a fight because the owners don't recognize the behaviors as such. Kind of along with this, dogs have more choices when they're threatened. They can show active or passive submission. They can show submissive grins, all these kinds of body postures. But when cats are threatened, they can leave, which is what you see this schematic drawing as showing. But if you can't leave, that's prevented for whatever reason. You don't know how to be submissive. You don't really know how to signal play too well. Then what are you going to do? You're going to end up being defensive. So they have fewer choices. And many of the problems that we see between cats are actually defensively motivated. It's not always a good idea for people to add another cat. In some research that was done by John Bradshaw, who's in England, he looked at cats in long-term shelters where they were maintained there for long periods of time. And he gathered some data and found that in this one group of cats that he studied, it took over a year for the cats to begin to show allo grooming and allo rubbing of one another, where they would come up and sniff each other, rub up against one another, and begin to really show friendly behaviors. And what most people want is they expect these new introductions to go well in several days, and sometimes it can take weeks or months. So that's one of the things that you need to talk to folks about, is that sometimes it will take weeks or months for these cats to really begin to tolerate one another. And that good buddies is not always the outcome. These are some questions that you can ask people ahead of time if they're thinking about adding a new cat and they come to you first before they have a problem. More or less what we talked about. What's the cat's socialization history? What's his experience with other cats? Does he seem to be kind of this easygoing, friendly, sociable guy? Or does any change in his environment just set him off? If that's the case, then maybe adding another cat is not necessarily a good idea. So let's talk real briefly about the most common reasons we see for conflict between cats in the same family. As I mentioned, the most common one that we see is at least one of the cats, maybe both of them, are fearful and defensive. So you see the defensive postures. They really want to keep the other cat at a distance, out of their personal space. They'll go out of their way to avoid one another. And when the fights happen is when they're forced together for some sort of situation, whether they're both going to the food bowl at the same time, they're going to the litter box at the same time. But in general, if they can avoid one another, things are okay. We had a situation like that, Dan and I, when we first got married. He had two cats and I had two cats. And most of the cats got along together, except one of my males and one of his males. And the biggest cat fight we ever had was when they were passing one another in a small hallway. And they were like, "You're too close and I'm going for you." Many of these fearful defensive problems can be prevented if we do introductions correctly. And we're going to talk about introductions here in a bit. Another really common reason that we see for cats in the same family fighting is redirected behavior. These cats generally have a long history of getting along well together, and then something happens. They're sitting in the window together, and they see another cat walking by outside. And they both get all pumped up and jazzed up about that. They can't attack the cat outside, so one or both of them turns and attacks the other one. I had a case a number of years ago where there were three cats in the family. One of the cats was sitting in the kitchen. There was a screen door that led to the backyard at the top of the stairs from the basement. So one cat, little female, sitting here. Other cat comes up the stairs from the basement, sees the screen door to the backyard, and there's a stray cat literally on the screen, you know, claws just like this. And the cat coming up the stairs goes, "Oh my God!" and then runs and attacks the cat in the kitchen. And it took us about 3 months to get those cats back together again from that one redirected incident. So these redirected episodes can happen one time, and sometimes they happen when the owners aren't home. The owners come home and their cats are trying to kill each other and they don't know why, because they didn't see the redirected initiating event. But that's typically how they present. They have a long history of getting along well, and all of a sudden it's like they're trying to kill each other. The other common reason that we see is play-related problems among cats, oftentimes between a new younger cat and an older resident one, where the new younger cat is just trying to play and make friends, and the older one is like, "Been there, done that, you know, let me have my time in the sun, I don't want to mess with you." So you often see the predatory sequences, the predatory play type stuff. One cat wants to play and the other one just says, "I don't want to have anything to do with this." Probably one of the more difficult types of problems to resolve are the cats where one cat is really being territorially aggressive to the other one. You see a lot of stalking, chasing, ambushing the other cat. It's clear that the resident cat does not want this animal anywhere in the house. Period. End of discussion. I find these quite difficult. Dan can comment on that when he gets up here, but I think the territorial ones can be really, really hard to resolve. So how do we prevent some of these problems first? Go back to what I just talked about. If we understand the nature of cats, we may be able to make some recommendations that in some situations a second cat may not be a good idea. And more importantly, we can help owners plan a really good introduction process and create an environment where we can kind of maximize the social distance, where we don't, where cats don't have to come together and invade each other's personal space to access a resource, whether that's food, toys, water, resting spaces, or whatever. You never want to advise letting the cats, putting the cats together and letting them work it out. We already talked about they don't have the capability to do that as easy as dogs do. Owners might have been lucky and gotten away with that with pairs of cats in the past, but it's certainly a dangerous sort of way to introduce cats to one another. When you have a new kitten that owners are bringing in for vaccinations, wellness exams, or whatever, be sure and ask people, how are things going? How did you do the introduction? They may have already set up several weeks of bad stuff before they got in to see you, but at least you can interrupt it then, rather than letting it go on and getting worse. You really want to help owners what we call micromanage cat introductions. Cat introductions need to be micromanaged. If you have an existing problem, one of the first things you need to do if the cats are fighting, as we talked about last hour, do something to stop the fights from happening. Because if they continue to occur, it's going to be harder to convince these cats to be friends. So if you have to completely separate them, if you have to supervise them in certain situations, or separate them only when the triggers for the fights are present, if people can predict when the fights are going to happen, when they aren't, you might need to teach owners to watch body postures so that they can be more alert to where the cats are posturing at one another, but one hasn't gone after the other one yet. They can interrupt it at that stage. If they're going to be doing some separation, you want normally to tell people to alternate who gets confined in what area or who is confined in the bedroom and who's free in the house. Because especially with some of these problems, if the same cat is always confined and the same cat is always loose, then if the cat who's being the aggressor one is always loose and the other cat is confined all the time, then he kind of gets used to living there free in the house and considers that as his area, and then that makes the reintroduction even harder. When you're doing this confinement stuff, I would suggest that you start giving them some exposure with scented items. And this is how you start the introduction or the reintroduction process as well. You take some old towels or washcloths, you rub up each cat with them, and then you put the scented towels of the opposite cat underneath the other cat's food dish, on their favorite resting place. If they like to sit in your lap, put it in your lap so that the scent of the other cat gets paired with good stuff. Here are some signs to watch for as far as being able to see that the cats are posturing at one another, that swishing tail that goes back and forth real abruptly, staring at one another, stalking in a real tense, almost predatory posture. If you see one cat kind of slinking away and you don't know why and you look around, well, sure enough, the other cat's then behind him a couple of feet beginning to stalk him. Obvious attempts to avoid one another and just this hypervigilance of what's going on, you know, always on edge, not knowing when the other cat's going to get him. I think I'll let Dan talk about this later, but for now, keep in mind that when cats greet one another, they tend to sniff noses. Dogs sniff other body parts. And so this is some of the initial friendly behaviors that you want to start looking for and promoting during the introductions that we'll talk about here in just a second. For cats, friendly behaviors can be much more subtle than for dogs. Just lying together in close proximity can be a very friendly behavior. Rubbing up against one another, grooming one another, those are real friendly behaviors for cats. And this is where you're going to take over, right? You talk about how to do introductions as well as reintroductions.
Can you hear me now? Am I on? Okay, good. As Suzanne was saying, perhaps the most important piece of all of this, if you're trying to manage, help owners manage fighting cats or to help them try to resolve a fighting cat problem, is the reintroduction, that is getting the cats together. And really what I tell clients is that when they've got a problem, what they're trying to do is they're trying to change the cat's attitudes about each other, whether it's motivated by fearfulness or territorial aggression or whatever it happens to be, play, out-of-control play, or just the redirected stuff. And the best way we know how to do that, to change cat's attitudes about anything, is to do two things. One is to try to minimize the opportunities for bad experiences, and that's why Suzanne was talking about keep them separated. You know, they're locked up where they can't see each other. And then the second piece of it is to create positive experiences between the cats in whatever way you can. And the reintroductions is the way to start that, to try to give them good experiences with each other so that they begin to make these associations. Oh, I see that other cat, and there's tuna in my life. So there's positive things associated with that other cat so that we can try to replace the bad association that they have, the fearfulness or the aggressive behavior, with this more positive kind of association. Play, fun, whatever it happens to be. Technically, it's known as counterconditioning, and you may have heard this term before in some of the other talks. So the proper reintroductions or initial introductions, even with two new cats, is critical, and as Suzanne said, needs to be really micromanaged. The goals for these reintroductions are really to keep the arousal levels low. The more calm and relaxed the cats are in each other's presence, the better these things go. If they get excited, if they get really aroused, then there's more chance for it to turn into a fight. So we want to try and keep things just as copacetic as we can. We want to try to prevent, as best we can, any sort of fearful or aggressive reactions, because the more often that they practice being fearful and aggressive around each other, the stronger that habit stays or gets. So we want to try to minimize that as much as possible. And, as I mentioned, produce these calm, relaxed, enjoyable kind of emotional states that then come to replace the fearful and aggressive emotional states that we're seeing in these fighting cats. Visual contact seems to be really important to cats, much more so than auditory information or even smells. And even though cats have terrific ears and they've got much better noses than we do, the sight of the other cat seems to be much more salient to them in terms of eliciting aggressive responses or friendly responses or whatever it happens to be. So keeping them visually isolated from each other, behind a closed door, for example, where they can't see each other, is ideal. Even if they can smell each other, even if they can, you know, hear each other, that doesn't seem to be as important in terms of creating this sort of bad interaction as the visual stuff. So having the cats in separate rooms, but there's a French door with glass in it where they can see each other and jump at each other all day long, that's not going to help. So again, as I said, you can allow them to hear each other and smell each other. Oftentimes that works. Occasionally you'll run into cases where even smelling or hearing the other cat will trigger an aggressive or a fearful response, and in that case then you need to take steps to keep them even farther apart so that that's limited except when you can control it. As I mentioned with the counter conditioning, pairing good things with the other cat is really important in this counter conditioning procedure. Getting cats to do massages on each other is really hard. I haven't figured out how to do that one yet. And trying to figure out what, you know, cats find good, what they find really pleasant to make for these pairings can oftentimes be difficult. Food tends to work really well with lots of different kinds of animals. It often creates a really positive emotional experience in them that then can be used to pair. Play can also be used, both with dogs and cats. The trouble with using play with cats as a way, as something to associate with the presence of another cat, is that play is very active. You're running around, they're batting something around, they're doing something really active. And again, that high activity, high arousal, high excitement level can sometimes easily turn into aggression. Most of the time, you're going to want things kind of calm and relaxed and not a whole lot of movement going on. So play doesn't work very well most of the time. You want to take tiny little steps in these reintroductions. The biggest problem people have when they're reintroducing or introducing cats is that they go too quickly. They see a little bit of success. They have two or three little introduction sessions. The cats aren't killing each other. They think, oh, we fixed the problem, and then they turn them loose unsupervised,
and things deteriorate again and turn bad. So it's really important to coach clients about taking these little tiny steps. You know, put the cats together for 5 minutes as you're taking a break from doing different activities. Or there's 3 minutes of commercials on the TV. Okay, bring the cats together for that 3 minutes and then separate them again. But do it often. Do it several times a day. And when you do them, each time that you're trying to make progress in getting the cats closer together or to interact more, you want it to be little tiny steps, not great big ones. And so you may need to kind of tell them what that means in terms of doing that. Sometimes the owners have a good idea about what tiny steps mean. Sometimes they don't. Again, as I mentioned, you can oftentimes do the odors. Suzanne talked about using the towels as a way to, or T-shirts or other kinds of things as a way to associate the odor of the other cat with something really pleasant, like sitting on a lap or food or whatever. Limiting visual contact. And really, the physical contact between the animals is really sort of the last step, allowing them to freely interact with each other, touch, noses, and so forth. Petting can sometimes also be used as a positive kind of association here. It depends on the cat. Some cats really like to, you know, have you sit and rub their ears or rub their bellies or whatever. They get really relaxed. They get real soft. They kind of half doze off. If they get in that kind of emotional state, then yeah, you might be able to pair that with the sight of the other cat or the presence of the other cat. Some cats don't like that. You know, it's all you can do to get them to sit still, and maybe they'll take 3 strokes of petting and then they're done. Well, clearly then the petting isn't going to work very well for them. But the goal, of course, is for both of these animals to get as close as they can to each other without it creating some sort of an aggressive or fearful response. So starting to work across a closed door like this is one way to do that. And here you see Suzanne. She's got a little toy feather here. And this is Buffett, our cat, across this closed door. And this was set up. And this wasn't a real thing. But assume there's another cat behind there that we're trying to introduce Buffett to. Luring him up to the door like this with the feather, you know, so that he's playing a little bit. There's something positive associated there. Or Suzanne gets him to lay down and starts rubbing his ears. Or, you know, this little can of tuna comes out, you know, right next to the door where he can sit and have that. And again, practicing very often, 4 to 6 times a day, you know, give people, you know, a range of times there that they need to do it. Then, if that's going really well, the cats can hear each other under the door. Maybe occasionally even there's a paw that comes up underneath the door, you know, and one cat starts batting around at the other guy in a friendly sort of way, then that's good. Then the next step is to start introducing the visual stimulation. And one way to do that is to just crack the door open just a tad. And you start out with it that it's so, the crack is so small that they can just barely even see a little bit of the other cat. One way to do this is to take the old style door stops. You remember the old rubber wedge style door stops? Well, if you take those and you jam them on either side of the door, this requires having another person on the other side of the door, so that you jam them under either side of the door, you can jam it open so that it's only open a little bit and it won't be moved around. The cats can't pry it open or whatever. So that's an easy way to kind of control that that amount of the visual stimuli that they're getting from each other. So you start out with just this little bit of stimulation they're getting. You're having the cats sit together around each other for just a few minutes, then you separate them. You always want to monitor how the cats are responding to each other in these situations. If you begin to see those warning signs, the threatening behavior, the staring, the hair fluffing up, growls, hisses, all that kind of stuff, then you stop immediately. You don't push them. Because once they get into that aggressive or fearful emotional state, it's very difficult to get them out of it. And all of these other sort of positive associations you're trying to do just aren't going to work. So it's very important that the owners monitor the body language of the cats and stop before it gets to be something that is either fearful or aggressive. Sometimes you can use intermediate steps. Once they're kind of okay across the door and they can see each other a little bit, maybe even touch noses across the door, then you can think about other kinds of intermediate steps. I mean, the final step is to have them totally free walking around together in the room. Getting to that point is what we're talking about here. You can use crates, for example, or cages. This is a really big cage here. You don't have to do that. You can use a cat carrier. And one or both of the cats are in a cat carrier. You can use the distance that these things are apart from each other as a way to control the cat's reactions to each other. As a general rule of thumb, the farther away they are from each other, the less reactive they're going to be, the less likely it's going to turn into a threat. So you start out with the cats that are across the room from each other sitting in cat carriers, and you've got you and a friend or a spouse or other family member. You're on one cat, you know, delivering little bits of tuna into one cage. The other person's delivering little bits of tuna in the other cage. You wait 2 or 3 minutes. You move them just a little bit closer together. Start giving more tuna. 2 or 3 minutes later, you move them a little bit closer together. And eventually, it may take several sessions before you can get them with the, you know, the cage doors right up next to each other where they can see each other and be right there and sniff noses. But that's one way to work at it. You can also consider tethering the animals using harnesses of various sorts. This is a new one I don't know much about, walking jacket. That seems to be a little sturdier and a little harder for the cats to get out of than the regular sort of figure eight harnesses that are out there. Buffett has learned how to get out of those really fast. So it works for some, doesn't work so well for others. Sometimes we've had clients actually install a screen door in the house separating the cats, you know, in one room or the other. And the thing that you can do with a screen door is you can use a towel or a sheet that you can put up over it. So you can start out with it being like a solid door where the vision is completely blocked, and then they can begin to kind of roll it up little by little. So there's just a crack at the bottom in the beginning where they can see each other, and then there's a little more, then there's a little more, until finally the whole door is revealed and they're just separated by the screen itself. In talking about designing these things, once you've got the cats where they're back together again, where they can be okay, thinking about how to create the environment so that it minimizes the chances for further fighting to occur, or in the very beginning, when people are introducing a new cat, designing the environment so that the cats are more likely to get along. As Suzanne mentioned, one of the things that people don't think about is that we're really jamming cats together in these high densities in houses. You know, we think that 2 or 3 cats in a household of 1,500 square feet should be just fine. They've got plenty of room there. Well, not compared to what they would have if they were out free-ranging outside. So we're really jamming them together. So we need to think of ways where we can maximize the distance the cats can get from each other within that space, and make it acceptable for them. Having more than one feeding location, for example, is really important. This also prevents one of the cats from kind of sitting there and guarding it, keeping the other cat from eating. We've seen cases like that where you know, one cat just lays here in the front, in the doorway here to this laundry room where the food is, and the other cat can't get in there. They'll do the same thing around litter boxes as well. Now all of a sudden you've got an elimination problem on top of the fighting problem because the cat can't get to the litter box anymore. So think about having multiple locations for these things. Scratching posts as well. Again, it's another basic need that cats have. Giving them more than one place where they can go to scratch is really important, prevents that damaging from occurring on the furniture. But also, the cats use that really, as you may know, they're scent marking when they do this scratching. And so they're leaving their scent around in these different areas. And if there's multiple places for each cat to leave their scent like that, they seem to feel more comfortable with the environment. Providing multiple litter boxes in multiple locations, again, so one cat can't bushwhack another cat going in and out of the litter box, and so that they're more likely to get in and out of them without having to encounter the other cat altogether. Multiple locations for them to rest. Cats like to spend a lot of time sitting up high, looking out at things, whether it's looking out at the room and watching the people and all the other animals going by, or looking out a window. That seems to be real entertainment for cats. So providing multiple locations for them to get up off of the floor, to use that vertical space, and to do observations both within the house or outside windows is really helpful as well. It leaves less chance for them to have conflicts over those sites. Providing hiding places, safe places where the cats can go to be away from the other cats oftentimes when there's kinds of fighting things going on, one cat finds a place, usually up in a closet, high up, where the other cat can't easily get to them, where they go to hide. Tipper, this one cat, very old cat that we had when we introduced Buffett, the cat we have now, she was 17. She didn't want to have much to do with him. He wanted to play all the time. She ended up living in one of the drawers to Suzanne's clothes. That's where she would go and hide out. It's important to give cats opportunities to hide out like that because then that way they can keep that distance apart from each other. Another option is to actually create a room or an area where one cat can go where the other cat can't go. And there are these magnetic cat flap doors that are out there. You can go to the internet websites, cat and dog supply places. I think Drs. Foster and Smith may still be carrying this magnetic cat flap door. But the idea is the cat wears a collar with a magnet on it, and this little flap here, it's a plastic flap, only opens when the magnet comes into close contact with it. And then it unlocks and will let the cat through. So the cats learn really quickly that they can get away here and the other cat can't get in because he's not wearing the magnet, right? Only one cat's wearing the magnet. He can get in and out. The other cat can't. So it's a way to create an enclosure, an area where one cat can go safely. As I mentioned already, the vertical space seems to be really important for cats, making sure that there's cat trees, posts, other places like that. This was Buffett in his younger years where he used to get up high on top of our bookshelf. And of course, when he would get up there, he would typically start knocking things off. It was an attention-getting behavior. It's like, oh, you guys aren't paying attention to me, and now this will get you to do it. For the fighting cats where play is the major problem, consider finding other alternative play opportunities for the playful cat. That is, make time to actually play with that cat yourself, with a dangle toy, with a feather on the end of a string, whatever it is that that cat seems to like to play. Try to meet those needs for play with the people in the household so that this playful cat doesn't end up turning to the other cat for that play. It sort of minimizes that opportunity. One thing to think about, too, is to take the playful cat when they have to be together and tether him to something, a piece of furniture or whatever, so that he can't really get at the other cat. He can be in the same room there, but the other cat, if he wants to move away from him, he can get away. He's not going to be chased and jumped and pounced on, and yet the playful cat can still be around the family, can be in the family room. He's not locked up somewhere. You may also want to consider for this fearful and defensive cat that's responding to the playful cat some sort of medication, anxiolytic medication, and we'll talk about that in just a minute in the use of medications here. It's unlikely that punishment of the playful cat is going to be helpful, partially because it's so difficult for people to get the timing right. To catch the playful cat just as he first starts, you know, to run after the other cat or to swat at him or whatever he's doing. The timing has to be really good if you're going to make that kind of punishment work, and oftentimes the owners can't do that. They don't have their squirt bottle handy. They aren't always there when the cats are, you know, jumping each other like this, and so it makes it really difficult to do. The magnetic door I just mentioned already is a possibility to kind of keep them separated and keep the play fighting from happening. As Suzanne mentioned, the territorial aggression problems are probably the most difficult ones that we see and are the most difficult to resolve. It often requires very prolonged separation between the cats, sometimes weeks or months, that the cats have to live separated from each other behind these different doors. And for some owners, they logistically just may not have that available. They live in an efficiency apartment. The only door in the place is to the bathroom, and the one cat has to live in this tiny bathroom while the other cat's out there. It can be difficult for people to do that. But again, trying to let them understand what's going to be required here, develop realistic expectations with regard to how they're going to have to deal with these things. Again, using the counter conditioning and desensitization, as we talked about with the reintroduction procedure there, to really help them to develop a more positive attitude about each other. The anchor technique may work for the territorial cat, the one who's doing the stalking and chasing. It might help. We've had a few cases where that seemed to be helpful. We've also had a few cases where timeouts for the stalking cat seem to be helpful. That is where you can catch the other cat, the aggressive cat, trying to do this stalking. He immediately goes on a timeout. He goes into the small bathroom. He has to stare at the wall for 2 minutes when he does the stalking thing. Use it in exactly the same way you would for timeouts for dogs. Again, the idea is that they get removed. Something good's taken away from them when they do the bad behavior. When they go to stalk or try and chase or attack the other cat, bang, they lose all social contact. 2 minutes?
Yeah.
Question? Yeah, go ahead. That's a possibility, and that's a good point to make here, is that some cats will, when they get in the stalking mode going after the other cat, they very well may turn and redirect onto the owner. That creates a whole other level of complexity in dealing with the problem and dangerousness for the family just in being there when those things happen. Sometimes they don't do that. They're really more focused on the other cat and they don't redirect and it isn't a big issue. But no, that's a really good point about that, and it's something that you'd want to talk with the owners about. You know, what's the likelihood, have you ever seen this before where you've tried to break them up, you know, that one cat's turned on you and that kind of thing, to let you know whether timeouts are likely to be a useful thing or not. The redirected aggression tends to have the best prognosis of all the ones that we've seen, particularly if you can catch it relatively quickly after it starts, within just a few days or maybe a couple of weeks after it started. They haven't had a lot of practice at really being aggressive with each other. It's oftentimes much easier to turn that around. Once it's been going on for several weeks to several months, where the fighting has just become more consistent, then it becomes more difficult. It becomes more like those sort of territorial sorts of aggression problems. But if they haven't been going on long, then it's just simply a matter of separating them and starting a reintroduction all over again. Even though they've been living together with each other for 12 years and know who they are, you have to start it all over again with the introductions to get them to go back to the same sort of relationship that they had before. With regard to the medications, again, we're not veterinarians. We don't prescribe. We do read the literature. All of this that we've got here is taken from Landsberg, Hunthausen, and Ackerman's book, 2003. Certainly they suggest that tricyclic antidepressants may be helpful in some of these cases. Amitriptyline and clomipramine in particular have been used. The SSRIs, particularly fluoxetine and paroxetine, Prozac and Paxil, have been used. Some of the other anxiolytics, the benzodiazepines, sometimes using Xanax and Trazine can be helpful. A lot of veterinarians are staying away from Buspar. Yeah, I was thinking of the other benzodiazepine, diazepam, that we're really staying away from that drug altogether with cats because of the potential for liver problems that we've seen in just a few of them. Buspirone is a very interesting drug, and it works really well in dealing with elimination problems, marking problems with cats, and also with a variety of other kinds of fears and phobias in dogs. But one of the side effects that has been noted with buspirone is that it tends to make cats more aggressive. So if you're treating a marking problem, for example, in a household where the cats aren't fighting or there's very little contact going on, sometimes putting the marking cat on buspirone will actually increase the aggression or cause fighting to occur. So that's probably not one of the drugs that you want to use here. Of course, administering these medications to cats can always be a problem. Trying to get a pill in them can be a real problem. Some cats are really good at taking it, some aren't. My understanding is that amitriptyline is a very nasty-tasting pill, and sometimes if cats get a taste of it, then it makes it very difficult to ever pill them again with that drug. These others don't seem to have quite the flavor problems, but again, pilling can be a problem for the average owner sometimes. You can get some of these drugs compounded at pharmacies, where they can put them into a little tuna puree, for example. It's aliquoted out into small amounts of this puree that then has the appropriate amount of the drug in it. If cats are really, you know, crazy about that substance, then they'll get all of the drug that way. The tuna tends to mask the taste. Really creative pharmacists can sometimes find other ways to do it. Again, there's some controversy about using the transdermals and whether or not the transdermals for these psychoactive drugs is really helpful or not, whether they really work or not. There's still some controversy about that. I don't see many veterinary behaviorists using those at the moment. My own personal experience is with the veterinarians I've worked with who've used these drugs on cats that were fighting, is that the paroxetine seems to work a little better for some of these territorial kinds of things and the redirected aggression problems. And in some cases, they're giving both cats the paroxetine. The fluoxetine has also worked. We've also had some success with that. In some cases, what we've seen happen here is that these SSRIs seem to depress aggression in general. So the whole aggressive motivation seems to be reduced in these guys when these drugs are given. In some cases where you have a cat that's just really fearful because the other cat is being really playful and just wants to play, he's not really being aggressive, but he's trying to chase him. The other cat's just terrified and running away and being defensively aggressive. Sometimes using something like buspirone actually helps. That is it makes him a little more confident, actually a little more aggressive. If the cat being chased would just turn around and slap the other guy once in the head, it would stop all of that. And so in those cases, the buspirone might actually be helpful for the more fearful cat. The use of the medication is really going to be kind of on a case-by-case basis. You're going to really have to understand, you know, what's going on, what the dynamics are between the animals to make the best choices about the medications. This is a good book, source book to go to for that. Karen Overall's book, of course, Behavioral Medicine, has got dose levels and all kinds of information there about using these drugs as well. The last thing to think about is pheromones, things like feel-away. They certainly can be helpful in some cases. I've not had good...
So I've had maybe a quarter of my clients who've used the feel-away with fighting cat problems who think that it's really been helpful. And the others didn't seem to think that it made much difference. It's certainly something to consider. I've not seen any cases or any reports of the feel away making things worse. So it's something that certainly the clients can try, and it may be helpful for them, maybe not. I think that's pretty much it. I guess it's our opinion here that it's really not acceptable for cats to be living in households where they're being frightened or harassed by other cats, where their quality of life is really being impinged upon, where they're constantly hiding out, they're losing weight, they're pulling their own hair out, they've got all kinds of problems going on like that. And the thing is that some clients don't recognize that the quality of life is being really impinged on with these guys. And so educating them about that, look, this is really not a good quality of life for this cat. You should think about, you know, finding him another home or are working more diligently with the problem directly. And recognize that rehoming is a reasonable alternative in some of these cases. Some of these cases we just can't make good progress with the drugs and behavior modification and changing the environment. It just still doesn't work. You know, they still want to fight with each other. And so from the very beginning, we talk with people about this might be an option. You know, if you really want to try and keep both cats, we'll work with you and do whatever we can, but recognize that not all of these things work out and that may need to be what you have to do here. You know, educating people about these signs of stress and so forth in their cats is also important. And I won't go into that. You know, fear, hiding, self-mutilation, weight loss, immune compromise problems as well can happen here. So this is what we'd like to see here, is happy cats out sunbathing with each other rather than... catastrophes. Any questions? Yes. Yeah, that's not an uncommon report that we hear about. That is cats who maybe have lived together for years and years, been just fine. One cat leaves the house for a period of hours. Usually it's going to the veterinary hospital and coming back. And then it's like the guy that stayed at home doesn't even recognize this other cat. In some cases that, you know, is just a little bit of hissing and growling, and then within a few hours they're back together again. But some cases it can actually start one of these real serious fighting problems, and it can deteriorate from there. I'm not really sure why that is. I mean, certainly there could be odor cues that are on the cat from the hospital, depending on what was done at the hospital, that could be masking the odor, so when the cat comes home and he sees this other guy, he doesn't recognize him. I don't know why. I mean, he doesn't look any different, but that might be it. If there had been some anesthesia involved, you know, teeth cleaning or something like that, the cat coming home may be behaving differently. You know, he's a little ataxic. He's not walking real well. That may cause that lack of recognition. But one of the things for people to tell people is this, well, just separate them for a few hours and just kind of, again, supervise that reintroduction when they come home, just so that you can see that it's going right and it doesn't turn into this fighting thing. Because the one thing about cats is that once things start going sour with them in their relationships, it's very difficult to turn things around. You usually have to move in actively to try to turn it around. Cats don't usually make up with each other all by themselves. Does that help answer the question? Yes. The question was, do cats seem to remember each other? That is, specific individuals. If a cat left, for example, to go away to college with one of the kids and then comes back for the summer or 4 years later, would they recognize each other? And I don't know. I don't know about that. I know dogs will. They can have that kind of recognition memory that can go for years about specific individuals. But I don't know about cats. It hasn't been looked at systematically. Yeah, the question was the scenarios where there's redirected aggression going on. One cat sits in a window, sees another cat outside, gets aggressively motivated, and attacks the other cat in the household. The owner then does a reintroduction, does everything, patches things back up. The cat then goes and looks out the window again, gets aggressive again, and starts all over. I had a case like that as well, where these two guys would get along just fine as long as one of them wasn't looking out the window and seeing other cats. And it's difficult to tell people, you know, close all your blinds and don't let your cats look outside anymore. But it's also difficult to try to desensitize that aggressive cat to becoming aggressive when he sees other cats outside. I mean, you know, think about how you would try to set that up, and the difficulty in really trying to change that cat's behavior. It's just very difficult to do. So sometimes it's a management issue. You know, you take waxed paper or something else that's opaque like that, and you put that on the windows where the cats can't really see details. They can't see the other cat, but you're still getting some light coming in so that it's not totally dark in the house. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah, the question was cats that seem to get aggressive with the other cats in the household about an hour before feeding time. You've got a regular feeding time, and then he begins to get aggressive. It sort of sounds like, just this frustrative non-reward. You know, he's cranky because he's hungry, and so he starts, you know, batting around the other cats. And, you know, how to deal with something like that. I don't know whether it's possible to go to a free feeding situation with those guys, you know, to abandon discrete meals so that the food isn't there. Another option is that there are these mechanical feeding devices, and you can set them up so that the food tray opens at random times. It makes it difficult for him to predict, well, it's not we're going to eat at 4 o'clock. Some days we eat at 3, some days it's 5, some days it's 2:30. That might be an option to try to deal with it. And another thing to think about, too, if none of those options work, is to think about the timeout option with this guy. You know, when he first starts showing this kind of grumpy behavior, bang, he goes in the bathroom for 2 minutes. And if he comes back out and it's grumpy again, bang, he goes in for another 2 minutes. Try that sort of thing with him. See if that doesn't help. Yes. The question was, could I comment about T-touch and use either in the exam room to calm cats down or at home? And from what I know about T-touch, is that there isn't any scientific evidence to support its effectiveness in... Linda Tellington Jones makes a lot of claims about T-touch. Cures cancer, you know, just about any other sort of medical condition you can imagine, as well as all kinds of behavioral issues. So there's no evidence that any of that stuff... That it's helpful in those ways. I think that the procedure of this kind of gentle massage with these animals in a really quiet kind of way can be really beneficial. You can actually get dogs and cats to relax on cue, just the same way that you can get them to sit on cue or to come to you on cue. You can literally kind of have that sort of emotional state put on cue. And I think that's what ends up happening with the T-touch. I don't think there's anything to the three-quarter circles that have to be done with just the right kind of touch on this particular, you know, meridians of the body. But just a gentle massage in a quiet sort of way, doing it repeatedly with the animal over a number of sessions so that they begin to associate that with, you know, being in the hospital or something else that might be cause reactivity on the animal, aggressiveness, is a way to counter-condition that. So the comment was that she thinks she's seen that be effective across repeated visits to the hospital by some cats, that is the staff or the owners using this kind of gentle massage as a way to kind of calm them. And I would think that that would be helpful. So definitely worth a try. Well, thanks for your attendance. If you have other questions, I'll hang around a few minutes. Otherwise, we're through for the day, I think.